Talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Welcome to the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on 1490 WGCH, presented by the Greenwich Sentinel Foundation.
Good afternoon, Greenwich. This is Beth O'Malley, and I'm here this afternoon on Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel radio show. And I am very pleased to have Ryan with us. Ryan comes to us from Next Chapter, and he is an addiction therapist. Ryan, are you there?
I am.
Great. Okay. So we are live now, and I have Ryan on the phone. And so I want to just introduce you a little bit, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the snow before we get started talking about our program today on substance abuse and the mail. So Ryan Suave is the program director of Next Chapter, and he is not only a trauma therapist, certified trauma therapist, but also a yoga and teacher, as well as a meditation instructor. Is that right, Ryan?
Yeah, among some other things, but that you pretty much got me. Thank you.
Okay, good. I know that you're also an advanced student of somatic experiencing, and we'll be talking a bit about that type of treatment on our show today, which I'm really excited to talk about. I've always done more, Ryan, in terms of my shows, of introducing subjects a little bit more like Addiction 101 or 12-Step 101, Breast Cancer 101. So I'd like to go a little bit deeper today, and that's why I reached out to you and to Hugh Nash, and I can't thank you guys enough for being available to us. You're down in beautiful sunny Florida, correct?
I am.
Yeah.
There's no snow coming our way.
Well, I just heard on our station that we are expecting 16 to 22 inches, which is unbelievable. And of course, there's so much excitement and buzz on Facebook right now about that. I just posted the funniest little video that I've seen in a long time, and it's a mom. You can find it on, it's called Mama's Page, or it's on my page, Beth O'Malley. And it's a mom getting ready, preparing to go into the grocery store, which is just hysterical. She actually has to suit up. First, she talks about how her cabinets are overflowing and they certainly don't need any food in the house. And quite frankly, everyone in the house could use not to eat for a few days. But then she goes on to say, you know, what would happen if they didn't have food? What would they do? Salt and pepper the dog, which is just so cute. And then she starts preparing, and she prepares by putting her hair up. So in the fights in the grocery store, she doesn't lose any hair. She takes out her big, giant hoop earrings so that they don't get pulled. And then she actually Vaselines her face on live on Facebook. It's so funny. She said this way, when the punches come, they'll just slide right off of her face. I got a kick out of that. All right. So in regard to the snow, we have some cancellations for Greenwich and the local area. So I wanted to speak to those. Today is March. These are closings for March 14th. And it is the River House Adult Daycare in Greenwich will be closed tomorrow, Tuesday, the 14th. In addition, the Democracy Cup presentation that was scheduled for Tuesday at 3 has been postponed to a later date. The Secretary of the State, Dennis Merrill, will present the town with the Democracy Cup, representing the highest voter turnout of any large town in Connecticut. We also have a cancellation for the Retired Men's Association of Greenwich, which the meeting is scheduled now, that was scheduled for Wednesday, the 15th, has now been canceled. The STD clinic at Greenwich Department of Health, scheduled for Tuesday, was canceled. And the Stamford Public Schools are officially closed on Tuesday. I have not yet heard, but during our break, I'm going to check on the Greenwich schools. But that was the Stamford Public Schools are closed on Tuesday. The elementary magnet school lottery in Stamford has been postponed until Thursday. So those are our closings in the area, and we're all banking on all of the snow. I know I have some friends up in Vermont, and they're actually expecting 20 to 30 inches. It's unbelievable. So we're all jealous of you, Ryan, being down there in Florida. Where exactly are you located?
Delray Beach, Florida, and I struggled just to put socks on this morning because it's pretty warm and sunny.
All right. Well, tell me, Next Chapter, I met Hugh Nash earlier this year, and Next Chapter is a relatively new program, but you guys have really done it right, and I was blown away by just how thorough the treatment is for addictions, but through the trauma, through the lens of trauma, not just looking at their substance abuse, addiction, alcoholism, what have you, in terms of process addictions, which we'll talk about a little bit on the show today, the difference between substance abuse addictions and process addictions, but that you're looking beyond that, looking at the underlying issues, and specifically developmental trauma as well as relational. And so that's the real deal. And back in the late 80s, early 90s, I worked, I had mentioned to you, at Breakthrough, which is part of the Karen Foundation, where we had folks come through a five-day program where you really got to work on not just the, you, for rehab, you'd go across the street. And back in those days, it was a 28-day program and that was it. You went and you left. And but we also would have folks back that many years ago coming through the five-day program so that they could work on the underlying trauma. And it's how many years later, and I don't, I've seen facilities say that they do it. I've seen providers say that they're working on the underlying issues, but more times than not, it's a little bit of this or a little bit of that and not really getting to the core issues. And people use drugs and use sex and use food and have different addictive processes as a result of underlying issues so often.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we see a big problem in our country, and it's identified as a problem. And I think the stats show something like 23 million Americans addicted, and I'm sure it may even be more than that. And we see the problems that addiction causes health-wise. We see the crime that happens, so the relationships that are ruined. So it's, the focus goes on addiction as the problem, and really, for the addict, addiction is the solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's the solution to a wound that's, you know, that's been there. So there's been something that they've identified that will move them out of whatever experience they don't want to be in very quickly. And, you know, I knew an old guy that used to say this. He'd say three martinis works a lot faster than a prayer. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was right. It just doesn't work long, and it doesn't work well. So the people, those who are addicted, it starts off as a solution. Then, of course, the addiction itself takes over and becomes its own trauma. And the behaviors that you live in and the things that you do to your body become traumatic in and of themselves. But the source of it is often a wound, or almost always, I would say, a wound that happened much earlier on that they were trying to medicate.
Right. And, you know, right from the minute one goes on your website or meets with anyone at your facility to learn about the program, you're right away talking about healing those core wounds. And that's crucial to moving on beyond the destructive behaviors that people engage in to heal those wounds.
Absolutely. And you have to stop the bleeding at the same time. So we have to help manage the symptoms, which are the addiction, the addictive behaviors, whether it's alcoholism or drug addiction or the many other process addictions that you said we dive into that come up after someone stops drinking often or using, and have to manage that. Just like if you were going to get surgery, you know, if they need to operate on your heart, your carotid artery is bleeding. They've got to stop the bleeding there before they can, you know, really operate on the issue that's underneath it. So we also have, you know, a strong component in dealing with the behavior, but while doing that, really getting underneath that core wound, and that wound that creates a belief system. And really what I believe that someone who's got a lot of unresolved trauma is their belief system has almost been altered, and you know how they believe about themselves or about the world and whether it's a safe place or not, and then continue to replicate certain behaviors that don't allow them to really live life to the fullest.
Right. And in that, you know, I'm sure you have thousands of stories as well, but the complex trauma that then when a person walks into your office with, there may be trauma from prior to their substance abuse. There may be trauma during that abuse. For example, I had a client who was actually homeless for 3 months and ended up having a sexual assault during that period of time. And then in recovery, I've had clients who are now 3 months sober, but their skills are not in place to a point where they're able to, where they're able to keep themselves safe. And I've had two young women in early recovery having sexual trauma as well by putting themselves in dangerous situations. And I'm not blaming the victim here, but there's certain ways of repeating trauma that we tend to see.
People who are addicted or have come into recovery aren't always the best decision makers right off the bat. I mean, mm-hmm. at some point, their kind of maturity, emotional maturity, or even mental maturity at times has been thwarted, you know, and often making decisions like a child would, and not always being in a situation that allows them to have, you know, boundaries that keep them safe or making decisions, you know, and not to mention, you know, the just using or certain drugs, or every time an alcoholic blacks out, you know, that creates its own physical trauma to the brain. And over time, you know, we can lose some of our ability to make rational decisions. You know, the prefrontal cortex can actually thin to where we drop into, you know, being almost like an animal where we only have an on-off switch mm-hmm. and only being reactive and only being to react to situations rather than respond to them. And that can not only perpetuate poor choices, but perpetuate certain traumas that can happen again and again.
Now, there are so many different teachings out there now in terms of dealing with complex PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder and unresolved trauma. What do you find are the techniques that are most effective in working with folks who have addiction on top of trauma?
Well, I think there's first off, it has to be a holistic approach, and oftentimes has to be individualized, if not always. Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably 1,000 different modalities of therapy out there, and to me that means it's worked at least once for one therapist and or one client, right? So.
Right.
A lot of the techniques tend to be an opening, an access point to really get to the wound and begin to resolve it. You know, so there's a lot of great things around talk therapy or different types of therapy that, you know, you can identify certain things or experiential therapies. But when I look at post-traumatic stress disorder, and I will speak about this in different places in the country, just breaking it down, it's post-traumatic. So it's after the trauma or after the events, stress disorder. It's really a stress disorder. And in some ways, and they've got to be careful.
Ryan, I just lost you, so just give me 1 minute.
No, he's gone. I mean, it's on his end that the issue is, not our end.
Okay.
Oh, I hear something now.
Ryan?
Yeah, he's. I wonder if he has a cordless.
Oh, maybe.
We're having trouble hearing you, Ryan.
I'm going to ask him to call back in.
All right.
Why
don't we take a break? And
Ryan, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
We lost you. I'm sorry.
Oh, we did.
Yeah.
No worries.
You were just about to talk about individualized treatment.
Oh, so I was still talking. What I had said was, you know, it often has to be individualized, you know, that, and I may have said this and you may have heard this, where, you know, there's many different modalities of therapy out there, and I would say the fact that they exist means it's worked for one client or one therapist. So when I look at PTSD, or we look at it, it's want to see it for what it is, and it's post-traumatic stress disorder. So, and after the trauma, after the traumatic or the event, stress disorder, you know, it's a disorder of stress. And be careful how we say this to a client who's really struggling with some impactful events, but it's really not about the trauma. It's not about the event. It's about our relationship to it and the stress that's left over from it. If it were solely about the trauma, you know, in the context of time, it's past and it's over with. We wouldn't be as affected by it. So we got to look at how do we relieve stress and how do we resolve stress? You know, most people in the United States, or most people probably alive on this planet, can identify with stress. But the people who come in to places like where I work are coming in with an amount of stress that they're having a very difficult time even functioning in the world. So the approach really needs to be holistic, where we need to look at and have an understanding of the story, of the narrative, of their belief system, but also finding ways to release that stress from their body and their nervous system at the same time. Because otherwise you might be just left with a very good understanding of why you're making poor decisions, yet still making them because you're in such a state of reaction.
Right, right, exactly. And that's where a treatment facility can really have numerous experts. You know, in private practice, it's great that I can refer out to someone who does body work or breath work or, you know, for yoga. But right in house, you have all of those experts.
Yeah. And we, you know, for instance, we meet as a treatment team every morning and really talk about what each client needs. I mean, because some of the clients are coming in, they're all individuals, you know, like anybody on the planet, but they're also dealing with different things. They've responded to different treatments in different ways. And, you know, frankly, some people that, you know, come to a place like we have been through this again and again in their lives, where they've been to other treatment centers or they've been to other healing centers, and sometimes have experienced trauma from that. And maybe this type of therapy is not going to work with this person. You know, sometimes, you know, it's often been said for, in 12-step recovery, which we're a huge proponent of for people. Yet, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't know someone's story and you're telling a young man to come in and say, okay, go to this meeting and find an older man who's been in the program and tell him your secrets, you know, which is basically kind of the message. Sometimes we might not know, if we don't know his whole story, that, you know, he suffered sexual abuse from a Cub Scout leader or something like that. So it might not be the best thing for him to do at that time. We might need to do some work with him before he goes out and starts making social connections. He might feel traumatized even in meetings.
Sure.
And so it's important to really get a good understanding of their whole picture and not put each person and not put them all in a box that says addict and trauma survivor. We really need a good understanding of the story, and along with that, a really good understanding of the family, because
right.
the family system is where, you know, the wounds are. And it's not really about blaming the family, or it's not. We look at impact versus intent, but people don't just come into the world with wounds. You know, they're in a system that maybe the wound wasn't caused in the family, but maybe the family wasn't capable of working with the identified patient in order to heal it. And so they experienced a trauma in the family at no, you know, no fault of the family, but
right.
we really need to understand that and then help the family heal too. So that when they step out and they're, you know, in a better sense of health, that they're not just stepping back into a system that's not working. So we really want to get a good picture of that and work with the family. We actually give the families a separate therapist to do their own work. Not just getting updates about the patient. They do get those updates from somebody else, but they're also going to do their own work. And
we find that
to be very important.
That's terrific. I've worked with a few facilities where there's a family therapist assigned to the family to do work with the family together with the identified patient who's in treatment at the facility, where I have here in Greenwich done the family work with them. But to have that continuity, that then is a third person, and then I would report back to the facility. But what you're saying is you have someone right in-house who is assigned to the family to work on the family issues, which is incredible. Because then you're seeing the whole picture.
And then, yes, absolutely. And then when it's appropriate, bringing them all together so that we can kind of get a good understanding. And it's really amazing. I mean, sometimes you can see the behavior of it might be their son or daughter, even though, you know, they might be in their 40s, and we see certain behaviors or certain reactions to things that are happening, and then go and look at the paperwork that the family filled out, mm-hmm. and you can see where the pattern started.
Right.
You can see, you know, what not only the parents went through, but what was affected maybe a generation or two above them, and how, you know, you can, it all starts making sense, and things that seem really crazy can make sense when you can get the whole picture.
Yeah. And that's where a family systems approach is so valuable to working with folks within their family system. There's something that I do with some of my families where I'll look at, I call it the kingdom of. And so it might be the kingdom of, let's, for example, say money, the relationship of the mother around her relationship to money, what she learned as a child growing up around money. And then the father's relationship to the kingdom of money for his life experience. Then two parents come together, then they birth children, and the children's relationship to money as what they've learned, you know, in public, at school, in their community, and then within the family system, and how that all connects together. And then we'll take that not just for family, but also, you know, the role of substances, the role of alcohol, the role of trauma, you know, whatever the presenting yeah. issues are. Well, what I'd like to do is take a quick break, and then we will come back and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the different treatment types that are used for trauma. And of course, not every type of treatment, as you said, is not for every individual. It has to be customized treatment. But then I'd also like to talk about process addictions and emotional or mood disorders as addictions. So we will be right back. This is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour at 1490 WGCH or WGCH.com from anywhere.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
Sunshine giving way to an increase in clouds this afternoon, low 30s. Clouds come in tonight. Snow develops after midnight, becoming breezy, 18 to 23. A blizzard warning midnight tonight through midnight tomorrow night. And a coastal flood advisory from noon until 4 p.m. tomorrow. Snow heavy at times. Increasing winds, blowing, drifting the snow. Blizzard-like conditions. Isolated thunder snowstorms, 26 to 32. Snowfall, 16 to 22 inches. I'm meteorologist Bill Jackwoman, and that's your Weather Center forecast from 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
The Greenwich Sentinel Foundation's mission is to bring together and celebrate our community. That's why the Greenwich Sentinel Foundation supports this show on our hometown radio station, 1490 WGCH, and why we email every single day the top five things to do today in Greenwich. We welcome new residents with our welcome basket and keep the Greenwich calendar at greenwichcalendar.org. And of course, we support the Greenwich Sentinel newspaper. You can learn more at GreenwichSentinel.com, and thank you for your support.
Hi, I'm Jen Graziano. Tune in Wednesday mornings, 9:30 a.m. for Time to Talk. We will encourage conversations regarding sensitive topics that we all need to prepare for. We will cover issues that span from legal planning to emotional and spiritual guidance and so much more. Join me for this important program Wednesday mornings, 9:30 a.m. on 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
Welcome back. This is Beth O'Malley at 1490 WGCH, WGCH.com anywhere on Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour. And we are here today with Ryan Swab, and he is a master's level mental health counselor, as well as a certified trauma therapist, yoga teacher, and mediation instructor. Sorry about that, Ryan. My New York accent slipped out there. I try and keep it under wraps here when I'm in Greenwich.
Well, You could use your New York accent in South Florida. It would fit in just fine.
Yeah, I bet
you guys
it would.
Are all over the place.
Yeah, it's true. We are. All right, so what I want to start with, we were just talking about different types of trauma, but what I'd like to do is we are all anticipating quite a bit of trauma starting tonight with this huge snowstorm. And I was joking earlier about this wonderful Facebook post that a mom in New York probably posted. And we are expecting somewhere between 16 and 22 inches starting tonight. I just accidentally started her video. So on that Mama's page or on my Beth O'Malley page, and maybe I'll share it over to my Be Well with Beth Facebook fan page as well. It's a wonderful video of a woman who said that we are in for the apocalypse and she must go grocery shopping even though she doesn't need any food. Which I just think is great. I turned into the Stop and Shop Glenville parking lot and saw that it might take 30 minutes to get up and around, and I turned around and went right back out. And I will be there later today with my Vaseline on my face, as recommended on this Facebook post, in case there are any fights breaking out in the grocery store over eggs.
So. Yeah, and I would say if you really believe it's the apocalypse, and it's the end of the world, don't go grocery shopping. Go do something fun.
Oh, you're right. Good idea. I like that.
And spend those last minutes under the lights of the grocery store.
Yeah, maybe I'll go for a massage after this.
There you go. That's what everybody should be doing.
Are you giving me permission to cancel my afternoon patients?
I don't know if you need my permission, but if that's what it takes, I'll give it to you.
All right. We have some cancellations here in Greenwich and the surrounding areas for tomorrow, 3/14/17. First of all, the River House Adult Daycare in Greenwich is closed tomorrow, Tuesday. The Democracy Cup presentation that was scheduled for Tuesday tomorrow at 3 has been postponed to a later date, which will be announced further on. The Secretary of State, Denise Merrill, will present in the town the Democracy Cup, representing the highest voter turnout of any large town in Greenwich. The Retired Men's Association of Greenwich will be meeting at another point in time, and their Wednesday meeting has already been canceled due to the snow. The Cos Cob School's STEAM night, scheduled for Wednesday, has been postponed and no makeup date. The STD clinic at Greenwich Department of Health was scheduled for Tuesday has now been canceled, and the Stamford Public Schools are closed Tuesday as well. The elementary magnet school lottery in Stamford has been postponed until Thursday. So those are the announcements here locally, and I checked. I didn't see it yet, but I will continue to check to find out about the Greenwich Public School System as well. And this is a rumor, but I saw it on Facebook, so I can't say that that's fact, but I did see a posting that all New York schools are closed for tomorrow, so that's probably exciting news for the children of New York City. What I wanted to mention is that I will be having Michelle Ablin on to discuss, we're going to be doing a full show in April on PTSD. And Michelle is incredible. She was a dear, dear friend of mine who I met probably somewhere around 20 years ago when we were both working as therapists in Arizona. And her specialty is PTSD, but it is the specialty because she had been in the business world and was flying every week different places. And in 1988, there was a huge Delta crash in Dallas, Texas, I believe. And Michelle was one of the survivors and then went on to speak nationally on her experience and became a therapist specializing in post-traumatic stress disorder, which is just, it's going to be a neat show. She once shared with me her story, and it's, you just sit there, you know, it's mind-boggling. So that's really a really neat, that's going to be a fun show. All right. So in coming back, we were going to talk a little bit more about the different types of treatment for trauma. And EMDR is the first one that comes to mind for me. In my suite, Jamie Klintberg is has an office right next door. And EMDR is an eye movement desensitization reprocessing form of psychotherapy. And there are so many different ways to address trauma. This is a very interesting one that's been found to be very effective. I also have a clinician I refer folks to when that would be helpful for them. Now, as a therapist, I don't specialize in everything. Most of us, you know, can't. But I have Iris Avishai in New York City as well as an EMDR expert. And I have found that to be helpful for some clients. I'm curious what different therapies you're using at the facility down in Florida. Next chapter.
Well, when it's appropriate, EMDR is one of them. Somatic experiencing, which is really, working with kind of all aspects of the body and the nervous system to really release, to kind of move slowly and release the traumatic response from the nervous system, where people might over time have developed a certain way of holding themselves or responding or reacting to things from something as simple as a broken arm or a small car accident. And they might have ways that they kind of protect that arm or orient away from a certain side where they were hit. And you can use somatic experiencing for so much more than that, but really to give people more capacity to kind of deal with life, because trauma is a part of life. It's not something that's so it's not something that's so special or so few and far between. It's something that happens all the time, and we experience
right.
It. And what's left with us sometimes is the stress response that we have based on our whole life experience. And so something like somatic experiencing is really great, along with EMDR. I think those are both really something to use as tools in the entire holistic approach. Sometimes people will come to outpatient therapy and they might have some very specific things they need to work on, and those approaches will really be effective. When we get into some really the complex PTSD that drives people into being in residential treatment for 60 or 90 days, we need to use that not just as a sole way of getting in and getting access to their past, but really as a tool along with everything else. Sitting with somebody relationally and being in group and having an understanding of things and getting feedback from others, and traditional talk and cognitive behavioral therapy plays a role in that too. Because we do develop a narrative or a story around what's happened in our past, and then we tend to live out of that. If I believe that I'm not safe in a certain situation, I can develop a narrative around it, very much like what you were talking about with the kingdom of money, with mm-hmm. the family, right? We establish a set of beliefs, and if I believe I'm not safe in a certain situation, I'll react like I'm not safe. That's one of the key descriptions of post-traumatic stress disorder in the diagnostic manual. It says if the person was exposed to real or perceived threat of death or annihilation, if it's something that was real that was going to harm me, or if I perceived it was going to harm me, I can, and along the lifespan, it becomes very different. At the risk of my mom listening to the show right now, if my mom, when I was 2 months old, had left me alone for a month, I'd probably be dead.
Right.
If she leaves me alone now, I'm 41, we get along a little bit better. We have a better relationship. There was a perceived threat at a certain age that's different than the age now. So it's important to really get in there and understand the belief systems that the person has and that's been developed in their families, and have an understanding of that. And then also have some practices in place. We use yoga not as a thing that they go to just for fun or to be able to have in our brochure that people go to yoga, but we have, 18 men who get up every morning and practice yoga. And we made that a clinical decision to help them build capacity in their nervous system. And yoga was something that was developed thousands of years ago, really to kind of help warriors and prepare their body in a way that they could respond to things rather than react.
Right.
And then also using meditation, different types of meditation to help people really still their minds. What tends to happen is, someone has a problem that they're experiencing, and that they've used a certain behavior or a certain substance or something to fix it. And that becomes, like the yogis would call it, a samskara. Like there's an action or an event and then we react to it. You know, the modern days, we call it a neural pathway, right? Our brain experiences something, and so we go to this for solution. And so, you know, when we can start practicing deeper states of meditation, you can kind of rest back from your thoughts and choose from them. And rather than being driven by your thoughts, be able to see them go by and pick the ones that are going to work for you.
Right.
You know, and there's studies that show that even, I think, 12 sessions of deep meditation begin to change the shape of parts of our brain and restore it. You know, the yogis have been saying for many years that the brain could change, and it took brain science a long time to catch up to it to really start talking about brain plasticity.
Yeah.
And so I think practices are very important too.
One of the most interesting studies that that I read was in terms of the damage done to the brain by the use of ecstasy, the drug ecstasy, and that just with a one-time use, that there is a change that, in layman's terms, basically, after one-time use, the user is not able, that individual is not able to achieve in everyday living the same level of happiness that they had, you know, prior to the use, and that every additional use of that substance alters the brain even more so and brings down that piece of the brain to almost a depressed state with every use going further and further down. And what the research showed was that there are a few different ways to heal the brain. One of them was a year of intense meditation could restore the brain to its original functioning.
Yeah. And we're showing that more and more, I think, proving what some of these kind of ancient brain scientists and the yogis were showing or saying back then without being able to actually see the brain. The problem with it becomes very difficult sometimes for somebody who has that level of, I'm going to call it depression there, or some sort of mood disorder or brain disorder related to the ecstasy use, to then, you know, function in a way that they're going to do deep meditation for a year.
Right.
So we've got to find ways to kind of bring that to people that's maybe different. You know, I've been fortunate enough to, you know, train with a lot of great meditators and then help train other teachers. And one of the things that I've gotten when I've kind of introduced it to people is they'll tell me, well, I can't meditate. And I'll say, well, why not? They say, because my brain won't shut off. And I say, well, that's the purpose of meditation.
Right.
You know, if you could shut your brain off, yeah, we wouldn't need to
meditate. Right. And that's the skill, is you're teaching your brain how to quiet.
Yes. And there's some really great forms out there. There's one that I've been trained in and used quite a bit. It's called Yoga Nidra. And it's a very old type of meditation, but it's Nidra means sleep. So it's yogic sleep. And it's a guided meditation done laying down. So it's the technique is really to lay down and relax, where sometimes seated meditation, people get wrapped up in the technique. I can't sit here. I can't do this. This one is designed to kind of disappear the technique and really guide the brain to the brainwaves of sleep, so that you're like kind of in the delta and theta brainwaves while being awake, and allow the body to kind of do what it knows how to do. You know, when doctors don't know what to do with somebody in an emergency room or emergency situation, and they've got them stabilized, they'll often put them in a coma. You know, and they're putting them in a coma so the body can be totally relaxed and do what it knows how to do already.
Right.
This type of meditation is meant to not put you in a coma, but help you just lay down. And I've actually seen people who've never been able to meditate that can lay down and do it and be totally relaxed. And I actually like to bring that to rooms of addicts, or we use it in our center at times, because they love it. They come up and they feel really relaxed.
Oh, that's
some people
terrific.
Say that. Yeah, they say that about 30 minutes of that will equal about 3 hours of sleep. You know, not that you can't then sleep, but in rest for the body. So,
right.
You know, there's things like that out there, and the more that we can introduce to people, I think, you know, people can find what works for them.
Can you speak a little bit to mindfulness and breath work in terms of holistic approaches to treating the underlying issues of trauma?
You know, like we were talking about before, I was saying PTSD is a stress disorder, and it's really about our relationship to something that's happened in the past or a fear of something that's going to happen in the future. What that does is it has me be, you know, I'm not in the present moment. I mean, we're always in the present moment, but I'm oriented to something else. So if I'm standing here in front of or sitting here speaking with you, if I'm really stressed by something that's happened in the past, you know, my orientation is to that. And I'm like constantly looking at what's happening now and navigating my life around how can I make that not happen again, or how can I avoid something painful from happening. So what mindfulness techniques can do is help you come into the present moment, you know. And you know, sometimes that sounds a little bit kind of ethereal, like come into the present. Like I said, we're always here. But allow ourselves to really, you know, move away from the fear of something that happened in the past or the worry of something that's going to happen in the future and be able to deal with what's happening in front of me right now. You know, what tends to happen is, you know, an example I use, like if I were to go to my wife and ask her to do something with me and she said no. Now, let's say I had a history of abandonment or neglect or something from women in my life, where I'd had hurts in a lot of relationships. All of a sudden, this woman who I love and I'm committed to and, you know, care for deeply says no to me. And I react like it's not only her saying no to me, but every woman who's ever said no to me, maybe all the way back to my mom or beyond, right?
Right.
And so now I'm not just reacting to this person in front of me. I'm reacting to this person in front of me, plus all the other people, plus all the other times. And that's not easy to deal with. You know, as we develop practices of mindfulness, it's actually shown that we can begin to train the brain to be able to discern between now and what happened in the past and what happened in the, or what's going to happen in the future. And it allows things, you know, we're going to have problems in life. And if I can deal with the problem that's in front of me as the problem in front of me, it becomes a lot easier to deal with, rather than dealing with the problem in front of me plus all of the other problems that I think it relates to, or all of the other problems I think it will relate to in the future. And so mindfulness practices, I think, really allow us to do that, to come into now and be able to deal with just one person saying no to me rather than 100.
I love how you describe that. And it's a point that I often will make to couples that I work with in marriage counseling. And it really comes out of the work by Harville Hendricks and Helen Hunt. They write about how in a relationship, when you're in a significant relationship with someone, your partner can act as a trigger for you from events from your past or traumas from your past, and use that moment in marriage therapy or in couples counseling as a teachable moment, in that your partner therefore is not necessarily, as you might be labeling them, very difficult and they're driving you nuts, but actually they're presenting you with a gift. And what better place to have a gift but within a loving foundation of a safe relationship to work
through
them.
Absolutely. Yep. And I love their work and the Imago therapy that came out of that. We actually use some of that not only with couples but with families to be able to have a discussion, we call it, you know. And the problem is we always have to remember that remembering that it's a gift in the moment that you're in reaction.
Right.
But once you can get through that, then I might be speaking from personal experience there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, it's absolutely the truth.
Right.
You know? I mean, some will say that's the purpose of the relationship, to help us to really heal and be able to heal from our past wounds so that we can love more deeply.
Right. You know, I was blessed to work with two parents of a child this week, or last week. And the situation was that they've been divorced for many, many, many years. However, in the moment when they came in to do some parenting work together on co-parenting, because they were disagreeing on one issue, and generally speaking, they're good co-parents, but there was this one issue that was triggering one of them significantly. And as a result, he was going on the attack to the mother. Now, they're not married. They have lived separately for 10 years. But I was able to create such a safe place that he could say, you know what, the reason that I disagree with my ex on this around childcare for my child is because of how I was raised, and this is what happened to me, and this is, you know, I was abandoned by my parent, and therefore this is triggering for me that you're saying that I'm going to now abandon my child. And it was just such a wonderful teaching moment. You can do that type of work with any relationship, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really a great example.
You know what I wanted to do, and I know I'd like to take a break, but just for those folks who don't really know, we're throwing around a lot of terms here in terms of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorders. How would you best define what that is in terms of symptomology? So I'll give a real basic example of that to start. I was out to dinner at Bertucci's the other night, and there was a crash of plates and all kinds of stuff in Westport as we were having our wonderful pizza there. And in that moment, I noticed that at the next table, a woman jumped like none other, and it was almost an overreaction to the situation. So that could conceivably, I don't know that woman, but that conceivably could be a PTSD type of trauma, a reaction to her past if there was some type of moment in her life where she had gotten hurt or injured or been extremely terrified by a situation. Nobody else jumped. It was really just her startle response was really on edge.
Yeah, and it definitely could be in that. I think the simplest way that I can describe it is PTSD is going into survival mode when we don't need to be in survival mode.
Perfect.
We don't want to ever eliminate our survival mode because there's moments in life where we need to be in reaction and like an animal. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be thinking. I don't want to be being rational. If a car is about to hit me, I don't want to stop and look at it and wonder what kind it is or how the driver is going to feel, right? I want to get out of the way. But we're meant to be in those, in survival mode for moments until it's over, and then we're meant to kind of come back from that. If we've experienced a lot of stressors in life, and like for this woman, it could be some stuff around loud noises, or it's never just the loud noise. It's what happened for her after the loud noise, probably in her past.
Exactly.
And so you can be startled, and we're supposed to be startled. In fact, startle's part of what saves our lives, right? It's that you're meant to startle for a second, like look around and go, oh, it's a plate that's broken, and then go back to eating dinner. Now, if there's been a lot of things that happened, maybe, you know, and we're totally guessing, but maybe in her childhood, her father broke plates as he was screaming at her or something like that, and then something came, you know, there was a real threat at a certain point, and then something got stuck. So later in life, she's reacting to plate that got dropped like was happening when she was 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years old rather than what's happening right now. So there's a great description of PTSD if you look at some of the AA writing, and it's written in the 12 and 12 in the fourth step. And the fourth step's about really looking at your inventory and your past and what makes you up. And this drunken stockbroker named Bill Wilson wrote this well before PTSD was even a term. And he said something like, you know, we all have instincts and we need them. We need a survival instinct. We need a sexual instinct. We need an instinct that's going to help us, you know, have shelter and food and everything like that. And when we're meant to have those instincts and we need them, the problem comes in, and almost all of our emotional problems come in when those instincts are awry. Like when I think I need more of this, when I think I need more sex to be okay, when I think I'm at danger and I need to act in a certain way around survival, or I need more and more money and more and more money just to be okay. And that all of our problems tend to come in from misdirected instinct. And that misdirected instinct, like I said in the beginning, is going into survival mode when we don't need to be in survival mode.
That's so beautifully put. And I love your referencing back to the work, the teachings of Bill Wilson, because I think so many times people downplay the 12-step programs and what Alcoholics Anonymous has really brought forward. But the work that Bill Wilson put together, you know, along with Dr. Bob, is just unbelievable in terms of providing insights into the human condition, really.
Absolutely. I mean, there's some gems of stuff in there. And I think there's been over time, there's kind of been 12 steps or treatment. And it's not an either or thing. It's an and thing. And not 12 steps isn't for everybody, but if it is something like 12 steps, I mean, people need an ongoing practice or something in their lives to be able to support them after they heal, and it's a great organization for that. And some of their writings are almost divinely inspired, I think.
Absolutely.
Ahead of their time.
They were, absolutely. Well, I wanted to touch on, we've really touched on complex trauma, relational trauma, developmental trauma, and its relation to the addiction cycle. We talked about holistic approaches to the treatment of trauma and addiction, but I would like to touch on process addictions and emotional disorders and mood disorders as addictions. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, process addictions are really kind of a lot, covers a lot of things. So it could cover things like spending or different food addictions or sexual addictions or gambling, things like that. Processes that we use in order to kind of heal the wound or give us a sense of healing the wound. An example I say is when I was in college, I had a friend and he had this old Volvo station wagon we called the Silver Bullet. And the alignment on the car was so bad that if you let go of the steering wheel, it would do a U-turn to the left. And it was crazy. He was this big guy from Wisconsin and he could drive that car. And if you were in the car with him or you saw the car from outside, he could keep it straight. And he knew how to drive that car. But what it took was it took effort, right? And it took vigilance. Like he had to keep his eye on the prize with that. And if at any moment, even if the car was driving straight, he let go of it, it would turn to the left because he hadn't done the work underneath to align the vehicle. If he aligned the tires, then he could relate with it in a way that wasn't hard, wasn't difficult, didn't take effort. I think what substance abuse is and alcoholism is, like we were saying in the beginning, it's a solution to solve that wound. So it's kind of like, I'm going to use this to make it feel like the car is going straight or appear that the car is going straight.
Right. Almost
process
like a Band-Aid.
Right. A Band-Aid. Yeah. And a Band-Aid that kind of can feel good. Right. And then doesn't work after a while and creates just, you need more Band-Aids.
Right.
I think process addictions are the same thing. It's anything that we're using to, have that car go straight or seem like it's going straight or look like it's going straight. And, those things will often pop up for people after they do get, they do heal from maybe their, or get sober from their alcoholism or drug addiction.
Right.
There are sometimes things that don't look so bad, right? Someone that works a lot and provides and makes a lot of money, it doesn't always look so bad, but is it driving them?
Right.
I think that's always the question with addictions, and it becomes a little bit more muddled with process addictions. But do you have it, or does it have you?
Exactly. Well, Ryan, I'm going to cut you short right there. I'm sorry about that, but that is a wonderful point, and I am going to invite you to come back on another show in the future. This is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, 1490
Support
WGCH.
For this program has been generously donated by the Greenwich Sentinel Foundation and listeners like you.
The station you grew up with. 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
Bad analysis, plea deal. I'm Chaz Henry. With the Congressional Budget Office expected to soon release its analysis of the cost and coverage scope of the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, the White House is challenging the CBO's ability. Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
If you're looking to get a bullseye accurate prediction as to where it's going, the CBO was off by more than half last time. So this is not about what my understanding or my belief of the CBO is. The last time they did this, they were wildly off.
As former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky sits in jail for child sex abuse, correspondent John Stolness tells us two former Penn State officials have pleaded guilty for their roles in the scandal.
Former athletic director Tim Curley and former school vice president Gary